All right, guys, should we get class started? Okay. All right, let's start with some prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for letting us all gather tonight and to talk about church history and kind of where our church has been and just kind of who the forefathers of our faith were and just the confession of our faith that was formed in this time. So Lord, I just pray that you can help me with my words and my ums and my talking quickly, that you just calm those nerves. And I pray also for the people here that they'd be able to get something from this and leave encouraged. In your son's name I pray, amen. All right, guys, so today I get to talk about the testimony of Christianity to the world. No big feat in that. And so my outline that I gave you guys, it's going to look at the how. So how did they do missions to get it around the world? The good, the bad, the ugly of it. Where did they end up going? Why did they do it? What spurred them on? Who did it? And then, yay, churches were established. So then what happened? And the impact of the Great Awakening. So, ready, set, go. I'm going to talk about the Catholics for a little bit, just because they are within our church history, and it's good to know what they did. We can talk about it. You know, they did some really good things, and they had some sweet methods, and I really enjoyed it. But I also, left feeling, I'm like, they did some great things for propagating their faith. And was it the true gospel? So I think that's where I was wrestling. But, so we'll talk about their methods. So how did they do it? How did they get, so I will say their faith versus the gospel when I'm talking about Catholics going places. How did they do it? So one of the big things was colonization and trade. So European colonization, what they would do, they would go somewhere, colonize some of the people, and they'd bring friars and missionaries along with them to help spur on that faith. Also a big thing during this time was trade routes. So they would use trade, talk with people, not just about trade, but also about religion. The Catholics also, they started a little society underneath the Catholic umbrella called the Propaganda. And when I always think of propaganda, I just think of false information spreading of some sort. Ha, funny. So that was a shortened term of what they called the propagation of their faith. So this was the society that they formed. It was a body of clergy that was aimed at spreading the Catholic faith to countries where their faith, the Catholic faith was either unknown or it was under attack, which also is kind of funny. It was under attack from heretics. So they wanted to go to these places, share their faith, and raise up a church there. The one main guy in this propagation of the faith was Francesco Ingoli. He was a guy, and I call him the investigator. He was the one that wanted to look at, all right, this Catholic Church, where has it been going, and what have we been doing in missions? So he did a little investigating of okay, how has our church been doing? He found out they haven't been doing super great. He noticed that politics were taking priority over sharing the faith. And he noticed that they would go to these native people, and rather than doing love and good works, there was more so abuse and alienation of those people. So he noticed their evangelization was not doing well. So the solution that he came up with was to form a College of Urbain, which was the College of Urbain, and it was put into effect for the purpose of training missionaries. And also what they did was they recruited missionaries. They financially supported missions. They printed liturgies and catechisms to go overseas. So they did a great job of being hey, we see this need to go to the colonies and to share their faith. So let's train people to do it and let's give them resources to do it. Props to them. So then I think, Phil, you mentioned it a little bit with underneath Catholicism, there's these little mini different sects of it, such as the Franciscans, the Dominicans, the Jesuits. And so all of them had slight varieties of their methods and kind of came into a little bit of tension with, especially in China, how the Jesuits were doing their missions. But there were two guys, Robert and Matteo. I could say their last names, but it doesn't matter. They were the ones that kind of went in to a place. They adopted the native dress and customs of the people. They studied their local literature. They studied their beliefs. They learned the language. And then they were able to share their faith, which to me, I'm just like, kudos to them. Because I think the big thing is when we do missions and think about cross-cultural missions, especially the Europeans, let's say I'm a European, like I do not want to go to China and create or them to make another European settlement. I do not want them to become Europeans. I want them to become Christians and Christ-like. So how do you then separate culture and the gospel? And how do you contextualize that? So I think both these guys did a great job of just trying to become like so that they may win some, which I know they're Catholic. But anyways, okay, I'm just going to quick read good old 1 Corinthians 9. And this is Paul. He says, "For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings." So we're going to do a little activity later that will probably be a little on the confusing side, but hopefully just to like narrow the point down of just learning how to contextualize the gospel without compromising absolute truth of the gospel. So anyways, these guys did that. And so that was one of their methods. Then they also formed some societies for foreign missions, like I had mentioned. And like I said, they did a great job of going to a lot of places. They went to Thailand. So they opened their first native seminary in Thailand. They did work in China. Like I said, the Jesuits were doing work in China. The Pope was not super happy with the work that they were doing. And so they lost their foothold within China just because the Pope was kind of like, don't follow the Jesuits of what they are doing. But they did have a hold in China for a little while. They went to North America, so they came here through, like I said, the colonies. They went to Canada because that was a French colonization. They went to Latin America, which we can see a huge still prevalence of Catholicism down there. And they also went to the Native Americans, so here in America. They formed these things called reductions, which I think is like a weird name, but they call them reductions, and they are self-sustaining and self-contained villages. So kind of what they would do, they would bring in some Native Americans, and I feel probably evangelize them, civilize them even, and yeah, raise them up in their faith. They went to the Philippines, which became a huge missionary hub, which I think also Catholicism is pretty prevalent there. They went to India, they went to Sri Lanka, they went to Vietnam. They went to a lot of places is what I'm saying. Like Catholics did a really good job of going all over. A couple places that were rough though was the Middle East, which is also still tough today. It said in the book that it belonged to Islam. So we can still see that today. As well as Africa. Africa was a little bit of a tricky one as well. And I think it's because Europe and power and wanting land or colonizing places, they were just in like rivalry with one another. And so there was no faith spreading at that time. There was also the slave trade that was going on then. And so Africa was not as evangelized in the Catholic realm. But those are a few things on the Catholics. Like I said, they did a decent job, I would say. And those few people that I mentioned. Okay, so now let's get to the Protestants, exclamation point. So how did we propagate our faith? Well, relatively pretty similar to the Catholics, there was still national trading companies. So national trading companies, colonies, and voluntary societies. So top two trading companies were the Dutch East India Company and the British East India Company. So these were in the early 1600s, and they were, which I'll talk about briefly later, they were both supported by the crown, which means that they were both under, like, the state of being supported. So what they would do, the Dutch East India Company did a decent job. They built up some missionaries, sent them with them. They established schools, encouraged Bible translation, and pastoral care of the converts, which I have to mention, They encourage Bible translation. And I think, like, I don't know. And if the Catholics ever translated the Bible where they went, maybe they did. I'm not sure. But I just noticed it. They didn't. Ha! So that's fun. So just another huge thing with the Protestants. Like, they really wanted to get the Bible into the hands of the natives in their native tongue. And just, like, how fortunate we are that we have it in English, not just in one translation or one, what do you call that?
Translation?
Yeah. We have, like, tons in English, whereas some languages are just waiting for their first translation in their tongue. So the Dutch East India Company encouraged Bible translation. And kind of a nick on the Protestants, but they had a slight questionable tactic. So they would send chaplains with them, and they would pay the chaplain for every convert they got. So it sounds like slight issues with the interest, if it's money versus a convert. But anyways, that was one of their tactics, was to pay a chaplain for every baptism they got. They did do a great job of, they also went to Sri Lanka, which they knew Catholics were there, and they built schools, translated the word. They wanted to kind of root out Catholicism. They opened seminaries there. They translated the word into Malay. And they had a huge following of believers then. So the Dutch East India Company did a great job. Then you got your British East India Company, which I think did relatively fine for most of the time. And then later they prohibited missions due to the disruption of trade. So basically they saw money and power or evangelism. This one won. Next way that the Protestants spread the word was through colonies. So the most notable one was in Puritan New England. This guy that I mentioned and I did not write down, his name is John Eliot. He was a guy that went to the Native American tribe of the Pequoy. And he did a great job with them. So what he did was, one, he translated the Bible, and he did a very similar thing with what the Catholics did with these groups of people that he's bringing together. He called them praying towns. So he would bring a group of Native Americans together in this Pequoy tribe. He taught them agriculture, trades, academic projects. And another weird thing about him, he believed that in order to Christianize them, he had to civilize them. So I don't know how I feel about that. So, okay, I've got like two nicks to the Protestants. But regardless, like, they were fervent and they wanted to get the gospel out there. So props, though, since he taught them all of these things, he was able to send them to Harvard to get an education and to learn about God more and to be able to be a pastor. So he sent them to Harvard, and then by 1675, so he translated the word in 63, then in 1675, there were 4,000 believers. So just like, what a sweet testament to living with the people, learning their language, and being just like diligent and persevering through that and seeing believers come to know the Lord and people come to know the Lord. Unfortunately, this is still in like the colonial time where people just wanted more land or more power. And so there was a war that came between like the colonists and Native Americans. So unfortunately that work kind of petered out. But still, it's just like a sweet, notable work of in those people. So colonies was one of the ways how they got the word out. And then lastly, they did it through voluntary societies and denominations. So some voluntary societies were just like, this is our duty. This is our duty to go and do missions. This was something like they probably read Matthew 28 or many other passages in scripture of, we need to go make disciples of all nations. And how do we do this? This was fueled by, in Germany, there was a lot of pietism going on, which is just reverence for this, and there was awakenings in England and America. They formed, the Protestants also formed their own society called the Society for the Propagation. They used that word as well. Propagation of the Gospel in New England. One of the guys, he was pretty great, Thomas Bray. He just kind of looked at the congregation, and he was just so bummed And not happy with the ignorance of the lay people. So just like of the people in the church. Awesome if a pastor is super knowledgeable, but he just wanted the rest of the congregation to be able to stand on their faith. So what he did was he promoted schools, education, libraries, religious books in order to promote Christian knowledge, which he founded a society as well, an acronym of the SPCK, which is the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge. Then in 1701, there was another society formed, which was basically similar to the first, but just going to the nations. So the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts, so the SPG. There were two guys, Ziegenbalg and Pluschau, who were, I think, the first members of the society. And they concentrated on educating children, translating the Bible, that's a very common theme, preaching the gospel, and training local clergy. So these four things, education, translating the word, preaching the gospel, and training local local clergy, all became the hallmarks of Protestant missions. And I think if you think about it, it's just awesome. Going somewhere, learning their language, translating the word so that they will be able to read it in their native tongue, preaching the word, and then training local clergy. So building up disciples and building up elders so that one day there may be a church that's a local indigenous healthy church and that the missionary, whoever goes there, does not need to be there and they can raise up their own church and continue it. So awesome picture. Props to the Protestants for doing that. Another group I'm going to like briefly talk about are the Moravians, which a lot of us are very probably pretty well informed of. They were small but mighty. I kind of wanted to just do a small but mighty. They, within 30 years, they had missions within 10 countries. And they were really known for their self-sacrifice, their love, their total commitment, which inspired many other missionaries henceforth. And I think even Wesley, or one of the Wesleys, was very inspired by them. So there's a little quote that says, "Wherever the Moravians went with the gospel, their loving spirit, strong faith, and commitment conveyed such an attractive example of Christianity that hundreds of converts were made. One historian has estimated that the Moravian missions achieved more in this period than all the Protestant efforts before them," which kind of says something. But also remembering at the time, there was a lot of Protestants being persecuted for their faith, and so regardless, though, it was a sweet time. They were super zealous for the word and the word to get out to different areas. So I would say with these voluntary societies and Protestant expansion, less was being tied to kings and trading companies, which kind of goes to talk about like church and state was kind of a thing going on at that time as well, even within the Catholic Church, of just like who has that authority and who has, where's the money coming from and that support coming from. But, okay, before I go on to the next little bit, we're going to try this activity. So if you flip your sheets over, and Emily may do a much better job of explaining it, which I may just say, hey, Em, what does that mean? So what we are going to do, so it looks like, so there's biblical on top and culture on the side. And what I had mentioned earlier was just a huge thing of if we are going to be able to share the gospel effectively to people that are way different than us, and we don't want them to become like us, we want them to become like Christ, how do we do that well? And so looking at this chart thing here, who can define relativism? Yes, Nick. Wow. That was good. If you need it repeated, he can say it a little louder. That was really good. What about absolutism? Yes, very good. So, what'd you say? Okay, so if we look at it here, Emily made a very good point of when I was drawing this out, because is there such thing as biblical relativism? Because the Bible should be absolute, and it's absolute truth. But rather than relativism, Emily, what would you suggest that word should be?
Freedom within the constraints of the law.
So freedom within the constraints of the law. So how did you explain it earlier? You said
there's negative and positive law. So positive law, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind. You can't love any other gods. That's absolute. Freedom within the law would be any kind of negative law says you cannot do this, but everything else
you can do.
So those are kind of the two distinct ways that God communicates through law. Most of the Old Testament law actually is negative law, which means there's lots of variation of expression within the bounds of God's law.
And that's exciting. Lots of areas for expression or diversity. And I think within missions especially. So, all right, this may not even be an activity. I might just talk through the whole thing. But if you look, so you've got your, let's say, biblical absolutism. So that needs to be, you need to fall into that category if you're going to want to talk biblical truth without compromising on it. So you can be an absolute in the culture, which I think, let's say, this might be a little rough. Or what do you think? What do you think if you were going to go overseas somewhere and you checked your box in, yep, there's biblical absolutes and there's cultural absolutes. How do you think that will go for you?
What do you mean by that? Like, what do you mean by cultural absolutes?
So there are, like, standards that are always true regardless of circumstances is my definition. Like, let's say there was, I think, an example that I read, like, about the Nazis. Like, they had this cultural belief that, like, it was okay to kill the Jews. Did you say martyr, right?
Yes.
Okay. yeah. Or, I mean, we could just, you know, go a little bit lower than that. Like, skinny jeans, let's say. We could say, I know, I thought it was going to bring a little, so I wanted a little tension in the room. So let's say a cultural absolute is to wear skinny jeans. Mm-hmm. It is. It's right here on my paper. So we have this culture absolute of wearing skinny jeans. We're going to go, we want to continue to preach truth, and we're going to go somewhere. Are we going to force them to wear skinny jeans? And that's going to call them a believer. If that's our box that we're landing in, like, that's what we're going to be doing. Yes, Nick.
It almost seems like you're describing the Bible plus these things. Mm. So, like, we're going to preach the word of God while accommodating to their culture and accommodating to what they think is true.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. But, so, okay, one more box that we'll, well, we could do, okay, so then you got relativism, which is not the, the biblical relativism, the other box that we have for her, or cultural relativism, so kind of like anything goes. So they're not standing on biblical truth, and you're just kind of letting their culture sway everything, which, have we seen that within churches today? Which is very unfortunate. Like, we have the Lutheran churches, they're on, like, both extremes, and you've got, like, a very liberal Lutheran church that is very swaying to the culture at this time, and they are not following biblical absolutes in things. So, what I propose in going overseas to missions is this bottom right box. So you want biblical absolutes, cultural relativism, so making... Strong work, Nick. So, you do not want to compromise on biblical truth, but you want to be able to make the gospel contextual to their culture. And it's tricky to do, and there can sometimes be an air of syncretism, which is that, like, mixing of religion and things. But, like, that's the hope, so that we can continue to have this diversity and different expressions for God. Okay, what a fun activity. Okay, so now that we've got places all over the world that are colonized, we've got churches that are set up, different types of churches even. You got your Presbyterian, your Congregational, your Anglican, which is still tied to the Church of England. You got your Baptists. We've got just things happening. Like I said, colonialization is still going on. There were many people, actually, due to persecution in Europe, they were going overseas to America and just planting themselves there. Unfortunately, but with more people, then the loss of evangelism, like, went down. So it was like wealth, commerce, trade, materialism, and then sharing the gospel just went down. So this was just about in, like, the 1700s. So there was, like, very slow church growth during that time. And people recognized it. And some of them are like, we need to have a, we need to reform, or we need to have this revival or this awakening. And I don't know. I'm, like, super interested to ask these questions after my talk, but I'll mention them now. But it just amazes me. Like, they were just, like, they just went out to do these things. They just went out to plant these churches, and yet now they're already, like, swaying from the wayside, and their faith is already kind of dwindling. And just how much today, or just how much in the Word, it's just like, remember, or lest you forget, let's be reminded, and how much we need to remember that as well. And so in the 1700s, people are realizing, like, what is going on? Like, we need to rebirth this church, and we need to wake people up. Because there were things going on, like in 1662, there was this halfway covenant, which, it's funny, you're either like in or out of the covenant. There shouldn't be a halfway covenant, but there was, and it was a moral versus a spiritual rebirth. So basically, if you're good enough, all right, you're in. And if you're in Sunday school this morning, like, Brian did a great job of, like, no, that, like, good does not equate salvation. So people recognize that we need this reform. Also, in 1689, we have our Baptist Confession of Faith, which, great book, by the way. Read it all the way through and through. I'm kidding. So this is actually would be so good. And so this is the Confession of Faith that, like, we all stand on, and this is, like, what we say that we believe. And I would encourage you to borrow it from Kevin. But one of the things, like, what spurred these people on to just continue and to awaken people up? So one of the things that spurred them on was remembering the Christian liberty and liberty of conscience. So, like, what are we free from and what are we free to? What are we free from? We are free from the guilt of sin, free from the power of sin, free from the punishment of sin. And then what are we free to? We have free access to God, and we are free to have childlike obedience to God. And so, again, some of these people were just, like, awakened and wanted to do that, and they wanted to remind people of those things. As I had mentioned before, there was this thing going on with, like, church and state and where that authority was lying. So there was definitely the Baptist Puritans, like, fought for the separation of church and state with that. And I think that probably was helpful with, like, the voluntary societies that were being formed, and they were under the church, I believe. So, with that, ooh, another fun quote with the thought of this, like, what are we free from and what are we free to? So liberty is not the right to do as I please. Liberty is the right to do as God pleases without fear. So these people, like, held to their confessions of faith, and they wanted to share that with others. I'm going to share a couple of big names for this revival time. And one of them is Jonathan Edwards. I hear he's pretty heady with his books, so I'm thankful you didn't give me one of his to read, but he was a PK, also known as a preacher's kid, at a very young age. I'm just teaching you all the acronyms. At a very young age, he was quite fluent in, like, Greek, Hebrew, Latin, and what we all aspire to do, and he did it at, like, 14 or something. But in 1727, he became aware of God's absolute sovereignty, and in 1734, is kind of when he lit the fire for people. He did a series of sermons on justification by faith. People came, they listened, and their hearts were softened. And he has a quote that says, souls did, as it were, come by flocks to Jesus Christ. The town never was so full of love nor of joy as it was then. So he really helped awaken people within the church. He had a zeal coupled with intellectual curiosity that really helped spur people on. And next guy we've got is George Whitefield, another great guy. So he became a believer in 1735. Then he decided to take a six-week tour. I just think it's kind of funny. He did a six-week tour in America in 1740. I just, like, wonder what that looked like for him. But he was a fervent persuader, and he was an awesome preacher. So what would happen was either he would go into a church, and if the church wasn't big enough, he would go outside, and he started these open-air services where crowds as much as, like, 20,000 people. And especially with him being outside, he was able to reach, like, the working class as well with his talks. He was big on charitable work and orphanages. I called him the travel guy because he just kind of went around. He didn't, like, stay too long, but he went, did his message, and he left the church and the converts to the people that were there, which he didn't just come to get converts or to share and hopefully have unbelievers, but he also preached to the people that were believers. He wanted to rouse the ministers. And he says, the reason why congregations have been so dead, he explained, is because dead men preach to them. So he really wanted to awaken up and revive not only the people, but the pastors and the preachers. So sounds, I mean, he kind of reminds me of, like, Billy Graham, I guess. Like, he would just come and do some, like, I don't know, actually, maybe I shouldn't mention that. But I just think of Billy Graham as a guy that just came, spoke, had some awesome converts, and then, I mean, he didn't stay in disciple, so that's when you need a Timothy, where Paul just sends Timothy somewhere and is like, hey, you're going to stay in this place, you're going to raise up some elders, and then your job is done. So he really wanted to give that responsibility to the people that were there, which is really cool. So that's George Whitfield. Next, we've got Nicholas von Zinzendorf. He was one that became a believer in about 1719. He was very well connected with the Moravians, and he had an estate, so big plot of land, that he helped when the Protestants were being persecuted, he allowed Protestants to stay there as well as Moravian refugees, and they formed a church there, and this is where, which it seems like such a sweet picture as well. So, like, different Protestants from different backgrounds. So you've got your Baptists, your Congregationalists, and all these people are just coming for refuge to this estate. And yet they were able to lay aside some of those differences and to work together. So Zinzendorf is said to be the pioneer of ecumenism, which is, like, promoting unity among Christians in evangelism, which I think is also a sweet picture, realizing, like, we are here as Christian believers, and Lord willing, we hope to see, like, the church built here and to work to that end. And if we are able to just set aside some of our, like, third or fourth degree non-doctrinal or, like, doctrinal issues and just remember the gospel, like, it's just a sweet way to have that work together. The last people I'm going to talk about are the Wesleys, and I apologize. I do not know huge differences between them, but they are brothers. One's name is John and one's name is Charles. I do have Charles down as the hymn man. So he was the hymn writer. And John, he was the one that wanted to create this method of spiritual improvement. So almost just like disciplines for this. So what happened was they formed this thing called Methodism. So before Methodist, he had Methodism because he didn't want to leave the Church of England. They were under the Church of England still, and they wanted people to still go to the services and receive the sacraments, but they really wanted to have these societies to just, like, grow in spiritual improvement and discipline. And so they formed these societies to do just that. And I believe after John's death is when the Methodist Church separated from the Church of England and became their own congregation or their own denomination. But they were zealous. They wanted Britain to hear the good news of Christ, and they would go to any pulpit they could find. And if they couldn't go to a pulpit, they went to the streets. So again, they were just zealous to get the word out to the people. So those are the few people that I wanted to touch on, and I'm just going to do, like, a relatively brief summary. So we had tons of things going on, lots of moving parts. Churches were being planted. Then not just churches, but materialism and commerce and wealth, which then dwindled the church movement. But then people woke up, and they were like, guys, we've got to get this back together, and we've got to, like, figure out our priorities. Then you got the revival time when people are just coming and wanting to share and be zealous for the Lord. So the impact of what the awakening was nominal members turned into active Christians. The clergy was reformed, and there were new standards for pastoral care. Mission agencies were created, such as the Baptist Missionary Society or the London Missionary Society. Christian education was a big push, and I think that's where Sunday school started, so yay to Sunday school for us. There was a passion for social justice, and this was a time of the slavery, and so they really wanted to banish slavery, and it was led by evangelical convictions. And lastly, there were hymns, so we got, like, tons of new worship music through this time. And that is how I'm going to wrap it up, and Tim will talk next. So, do we have any questions? Anyways, thanks, guys.